I have a saying that I often use when confronted with situations that seem to be dragging on and on and on. Jesus will return before this is sorted out. It's an attempt at humour in the face of frustrating delays and apparent human incompetence. But at another level, I rather do expect and hope that it will happen. Such a decisive and final divine intervention would solve all problems, including the problem of me. I'm particularly inclined to use this phrase at this time of the year, when the readings in the lead-up to Advent and at the start of this important season say in the most unmistakable way that this is precisely what is going to happen. There's a reason why we're getting this high-powered dose of end-time talk right now. Soon we'll be concentrating on the first coming of Christ in our world in vulnerability and helplessness, as indeed all babies and toddlers are. He took a shape and a form to fit in with us, and that was the price tag. Then the season to follow will track his human journey from, as one commentator memorably put it, from crib to cross. A 30-year human sojourn characterized by weakness and suffering, an aspect of the gospel that we're usually keen to dodge. Then in the season of joy that follows that, we'll celebrate the resurrection, his rising to be at the right hand of the Father, a royal place of kingly reigning that we recalled last Sunday. He remains there for now in the brief passage of time called human history, but as surely as the night follows the day, he must return. This is just the gracious interval allowed by a patient God to give the human race an opportunity to turn to him and to be united to him. The key phrase I'm focusing on this morning is, "They will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." They will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. This is the way we're told to expect the manner of a second coming. We have a problem, I think, with this way of describing the return of Jesus, so removed as it is from the way we might think about the end of the world. But for Luke, Matthew and Mark, this is the way Peter, James and John had reported seeing the transcendent Jesus in a brief moment of heavenly glory on Mount Tabor at the Transfiguration. The voice that spoke from the cloud declared Jesus to be the beloved and divinely approved Son. He shone with uncreated light and transcendent glory. So the gospel writers are looking back to the only experience the core group of disciples had of the way Jesus is in his native and natural state of existence with the Father in the heavenly realms, and as they assumed he would be when he returned. The transcendent and transfigured Jesus is the way Jesus really is when he's being himself within the life of God, and this is the way he will appear when he returns. The other portions of all this apocalyptic talk are more within our thought world. Disaster news and the clamour of nations is the stuff of our over-informed, continual exposure to world news. It's also becoming clear that the 21st century will be a time of mounting ecological catastrophes. This is the new normal. But Jesus has words of warning about this kind of expectation. Don't think you can read into a mounting crescendo of catastrophes a divine timetable for when the end time will be. Don't try and second guess God about when he will ring the curtain down on the human story. Not even I know when that will be. Only the Father does. Here we might notice that Jesus appears to be saying at several points in his urgent appraisals of the end times that he expects it to happen within a generation. So even he got it wrong. Jesus also warns about false teachers who read supernatural signs into the distress of nations and the rise and fall of empires to suit their own weird agendas, which usually have little to do with human flourishing. They don't have a hotline to God. They aren't reliable interpreters of the deep underlying patterns of the meaning of human history. They don't understand the deep underlying patterns of what's really going on behind the scenes. Don't get sucked into following their mad schemes, he says. That was good advice for the early Christian community when Jewish nationalist extremists tried to lure them into joining the suicidal revolt against Roman rule. Stay out of it was a blueprint for survival. There are three other tips on how to do well when the stars begin to fall in today's readings. The first letter to the Christians at Thessalonica has two of them. Be a praying person. Put prayer at the centre of your life. Pursue the disciplined search for holiness. This is how you demonstrate your special relationship to the God of history and the one he has sent. This is how you position yourself in the lineup of loyalties to the one who really does have ultimate power and sovereignty over this world and the one to follow it. Secondly, put love at the centre of your life. Not just introverted love for the small Christian community you know well, but the kind of generous love that includes many others and that releases the energies of the kingdom. That, of course, is to be a wise love. I think here of the Reverend Vincent Brian King, son of Father Brian King, who put this parish on its Anglo-Catholic path, the priest who became the renowned social worker, spiritual leader of Dunedin's interwar years. It was said he had a sixth sense in his ability to distinguish between scrounging panhandlers and those in genuine need. This latter group received his wholehearted and timely support. Back to Luke. His advice is to be alert, stand erect, don't panic, be full of courage while all around you are full of despair. Alertness means you don't assume that time is just drifting on without getting anywhere or meaning anything. The providence of the Lord stands behind the pattern of events in our world. Be expectant. Don't get lost in the deadening analgesics of whatever diversions and escapist behaviours your society and your culture offer. Look reality in the face. Stand tall. Stay focused on the ultimate happiness of the kingdom. Luke had some clear ideas about the ultimate happiness of the kingdom. He thought the Beatitudes had spelt out the kind of people who can expect to inhabit the kingdom. He puts into the mouth of Mary, in the Magnificat, the kind of reversal of present conditions and the end of iniquity and oppression that God will bring about by a sovereign command when he returns. The establishment of justice and peace will be the forefront of second coming agendas. In the parable of the rich man and poor Lazarus, he portrayed the kind of personal and social deliverance, the renewal of body and soul that will come about when the Messiah comes in power and glory. In this Advent season, we'll be listening to lashings of colourful pictorial language of end-time judgment and calamitous happenings brought about by the God of history. The New Testament draws on a literary and theological resource called apocalyptic literature, a secret resistance language that Jewish people had developed under foreign oppression to reassure themselves that God would have the last word in the human story and that they would be set free. It's a way of talking about these kind of realities that we are not accustomed to, but at its core is a powerful reality that changed the course of human history. God has raised his beloved Son, the Messiah, from the dead, a stupendous miracle, and that has set in train a series of consequences of unstoppable momentum. Apocalyptic literature provided a way of talking about that and of unpacking its meaning. When the end of the world comes, whenever that may be, and for whatever reason, the risen one would be and will be at the centre of the action. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.